pleasure to have Scott Patterson here today from ANU to tell us what fusion categories are.
Thank you. So I should start with one or two apologies. So first of all, I know that this is officially called the Differential Geometry Seminar, and there's going to be very, very little geometry or anything differential in what follows. I hope you'll forgive me. The second apology to make is that until yesterday, I was actually slightly confused about the order in which this seminar and the colloquium occurred. And I sort of planned things to some extent so that the colloquium talk provided some of the motivation and sort of background for talking about the stuff that I'm going to talk about right now. So maybe I just have to ask you to come along to the colloquium and in retrospect realize why on earth I wanted to talk about the things that I'm going to talk about right now. We'll see how it goes. Okay, so I'm going to talk about fusion categories today, and I'm going to try and just give you an overview of what sort of objects they are in mathematics, a little bit about why we care about them, but come to the colloquium for a bit more on that, and then try and give you a sense of the very preliminary point we're at in actually understanding these things. It's still a very big and mysterious subject, and I feel like we're just sort of just entering the subject now, and so I want to try and sort of explain the sorts of things we don't know about fusion categories as well as the sorts of things we do know. Okay. So what is a fusion category? Well, let me draw a big picture first. So fusion categories are, you should think, a common generalization of two slightly more familiar things. Well, one of these things is much more familiar, and one of them is perhaps a very common generalization. So here's my big blob to indicate the world of all fusion categories. And then one little blob I want to draw inside of here is RepG, the representation theory of a finite group, okay? Which is something that's very classical, and I think that everyone has at least some experience with what the representation theory of a finite group looks like. And then another little blob that I want to draw inside of this picture is something a little bit less familiar, but still quite important, which is the representation theory of a quantum group at a root of unity. So here, G is meant to indicate some complex semi-simple Lie algebra, D8 or E7 or the SLs and SPs and so on, all the sort of classical Lie algebras. But then there are these quantum versions of the classical Lie algebras. So UQG here is the quantum enveloping algebra of one of these things. And then if you think about the representation theory, when Q is a root of unity, you get some class of objects, which I'm sort of trying to indicate by this plot here. I'm not going to assume that anyone knows anything about this, but if people in the audience are in the happy state of knowing something about this, it's sort of, I think it'll help you, it'll help think about fusion categories. Okay. So, I need to, I think, tell you the actual definition of a fusion category.
Is representation theory of like a Lie group or comedy or something also in there?
No. So, as soon as I write down the definition, you'll see why. So let me write down the definition. You'll see why representations of Lie groups fall outside as well. They fall outside of it, but in a somehow a the thing that goes wrong isn't that bad. Okay. So a fusion category is semi-simple tensor category. I'm going to come back and say something about everything in here. Finitely many simple objects. And here, maybe let me just say what I mean by tensor category for a moment. Here, tensor category means it's a category that's monoidal, so you can take tensor products of things, both objects and morphisms. It's linear, that is, the morphism spaces in this category are vector spaces, and everything plays nicely with that vector space structure. And then rigid, which I'll say more about in a moment, but roughly it just means that everything in this category has a very well-behaved dual. Okay, now, this is lots and lots of adjectives to throw at you all at once, but let's just go through it all again and think about the case of the representation theory of a finite group. Okay, so if you fix your favorite finite group, there is some finite collection of irreducible representations of that finite group. Those are our finitely many simple objects. And an arbitrary finite dimensional representation of a finite group decomposes uniquely into a direct sum of a whole bunch of those simple objects. And so that's what you should be thinking here for semi-simple, that there's a collection of simples and everything decomposes into direct sums of those simples. If you take a pair of representations of a finite group, you can form a tensor product just as a vector space at first, and then you can give that tensor product vector space the structure of a representation. That is, you can take representations of a finite group and tensor them together, you get a new representation, and that's what I mean by the category being monoidal. These categories are linear. If I give you two different representations of a finite group and look at the space of maps between those that intertwine the group action, that's obviously a vector space of maps. I can take two maps between representations, I can add them, I can multiply them by scalars. That's linear. And now finally, if I have a representation of a finite group, it has a dual representation. And that dual representation is nice in ways that perhaps we'll just illustrate as we go along. So I'll be rather vague for just now about what I'm asking for from the duals of objects. Okay. So we'll say a little bit more about the precise relationship between fusion categories, which are perhaps these very abstract-looking things, and the concrete finite groups in a second. But let me just say one or two things about sort of immediate consequences of these axioms. So every object in a fusion category has a dimension. Let's just write a little formula for this. The dimension of some object X is this picture here, which is an element of the ground field, whatever field all your vector spaces are defined over. And what's this here? Well, this top half of the picture here is meant to be the pairing map between our object X we're talking about and its dual object to the ground field. So just think about plain old vector spaces for a moment, or representations of finite groups. If you have a vector space and its dual vector space, there's a natural map that comes with it from the tensor product of the dual vector space to the ground field just by evaluating linear functional on the vector space. That works for representations of finite groups, and this adjective rigid here is just saying that we expect this of our categories. Every object has a dual object and a nice pairing map between the dual object and itself. And this other map here, did I do that right? Yep. This is the co-pairing map going back the other way. If you think about just vector spaces or representations of finite groups, you can see how to write down a map like this. Maybe you might want to pick a basis to define it or something like that, but there's always a map from, I wrote K here and 1 here. Let's write K again. Sorry. Let's not write K at a time. Okay. Let's write 1 at a time. Okay. So, what is 1? Well, 1 is the monoidal identity in our monoidal category. It's the thing that you tensor with and nothing changes. So for a representation of a finite group, it's the trivial representation. And for, I mean, if you're looking at representations of finite groups, that trivial representation is the ground field, which explains why I wrote the ground field instead of one. Okay. So what's this picture now? Well, you can take these two maps and just do this map first, and then follow it by this map. Okay, just do one after the other, and that's what, whenever you see me draw pictures on the board, you want to read them from bottom to top, interpreting the pieces as maps, and just composing them together as you scan from bottom to top. Now, this little picture here that I've just described ends up being some map from the trivial object to the trivial object. And although I haven't said it explicitly, we expect that trivial object to be simple, meaning that its endomorphisms is just this one-dimensional vector space. So we can interpret a map from the trivial object to the trivial object as an element of the ground field. Okay, so that's the notion of dimension. Now, of course, if you're working with representations of finite groups, this dimension is just going to be the dimension of the underlying vector space. But the thing to be warned about right away is that in a general fusion category, one indication that you're sort of outside the space of representations of finite groups is that this dimension need not be an integer in general. Although, with just a tiny bit of work, you can see it's an algebraic integer. And with a huge amount of work, you can see it's a cyclotomic integer. Maybe we'll mention that again later. Okay, so I want to say something concrete about the relationship between this, the whole space of fusion categories and representations of finite groups. So here's sort of an analogy. Just as C-star algebras are and non-commutative Hausdorff spaces, by which I mean you take your favorite Hausdorff space, you look at the algebra of functions on that Hausdorff space, and write down everything you know about the algebra of functions on a Hausdorff space, and then cross out the one thing that you wrote down, saying that f times g is equal to g times f. What you'll have remaining on your page is exactly the definition of the C-star algebra. So C-star algebra is what you get by taking functions on Hausdorff spaces and dropping the adjective commutative. In exactly this sense, a fusion category is a non-commutative finite group. So to make this precise, we say a tensor category is symmetric if there are natural maps taking you from x tensor y to y tensor x for every pair of objects x and y. You can permute the factors in tensor products. And you want a little bit more. I mean, these maps have to be natural, which means something precise, of course. And you want that if you have some longer tensor product, say x tensor y tensor z tensor w, then these maps give you a representation of the symmetric group on all the factors. That is, it doesn't matter how you apply these switch maps, swapping two adjacent products, just the permutation that succession of switch maps determines. Describes the mapping. Okay, so that's what it means for a tensor category to be symmetric. And then the theorem that justifies this statement here, due to Deligne, although never stated in print exactly like this, a symmetric fusion category we need to add a little bit more beyond symmetric to make this really work. We have to say, with all objects having integer dimensions in the sense of dimension that I just described there, is the representation category. Of some finite. Well, super, perhaps. So this theorem tells you that in some sense,
fusion categories really are just sort of some relaxation of the notion of the representations of a finite group. Notice something a little bit funny here has gone on. In this first analogy, we took functions on our Hausdorff space and let them be non-commutative. Here we're taking representations of our finite group and letting those be non-commutative rather than functions. Okay. You can also weaken this theorem in lots of ways. You can throw out the all objects having digit dimensions condition and replace it with some sure functor vanishes or various tensor products grow sub-exponential, various other things. The integer dimension part is not really what you should pay attention to. Okay.
But you're not just dropping commutativity, you're also somehow moving into fractional dimensions.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. So my claim that it's not really fair to say that this is an exact analogy.
I mean, we probably have some intuitive idea or feeling about
dropping symmetry.
Dropping symmetry, going from topological spaces to C-star algebras, but I have no idea how we should think of dropping integer dimension.
Yeah, okay, so here's maybe one thing that you could think about. So first of all, I want to say that there are very few instances of symmetric fusion categories where the objects don't have integer dimensions. So somehow kind of the gap that you're worrying about is almost an empty one anyway in terms of examples.
Is this a rigorous statement?
No. Yeah, that's a phenomenological statement about what we've seen so far. So let me tell you something about dimensions, maybe it'll help. Often, this is not a statement about all fusion categories, but often, and you can add some adjectives to make this a precise statement, the dimension of X is the asymptotic growth rate of the dimension of the space of Homs from your trivial object to the nth tensor power of your object. So somehow, this is like asking how many copies of the trivial representation are there inside some tensor power, and this dimension grows exponentially, and that growth rate is this dimension here. So it's that maybe at least tells you something you can do with the dimension even when it's not an integer. The way to think about this theorem is that if you have a C-star algebra, but it has points, then it's got to be a functions on some space. And here the idea is roughly that if your objects have integer dimensions, then you have a functor to vector spaces. Every object in your category really is a vector space with some extra structure. And this theorem is then saying the only way you can have extra structure is as representations of some. So these are general fusion categories are ones where the objects don't have underlying vector spaces. Okay, so why study these things? So far I've just told you some kind of weird generalization of the notion of a finite group. I think my reason for studying them, you'll have to come to the colloquium to hear a bit more about. So let me just sort of be quick in saying some things about why you study them. Well, the extremely optimistic thing that really hasn't been borne out by what we've all achieved so far is that you might learn something new about finite groups themselves. I don't really have time to go into that. So, but various people who work on fusion categories have secret plans to go back and prove theorems purely about finite groups in sort of new and cleaner ways. Okay. The fusion category gives the 2 plus 1 dimensional local field theory, or topological quantum field theory, is maybe another way to say the same thing.
So very roughly, this is a gadget so that for every 3 manifold, we assign some number, and to every 2 manifold, we assign some vector space in some very nice way. But basically, the local here is saying that you can compute these things that you associate to manifolds by chopping the manifolds up into pieces in a certain way, looking at what the fusion category, what the field theory associates to the pieces, and then putting them back together by some algebraic operations. Now, these 2+1 dimensional local field theories are extremely interesting objects themselves, and I'm going to tell you in the colloquium about something that you might do with them that is kind of cool. But they're very hard to come by, and this statement is that if you have a fusion category, you get one of these things, and in fact, this is a bijective correspondence. A fusion category is exactly is precisely the algebraic data that specifies one of these local field theories. You can go back and forth between the full local field theory and just the fusion category, which is just some sort of small core of the full thing. And so there are a lot of connections with low dimensional topology and physics through that correspondence. And then,
so we expect something like some of Alan Jones' work on knot theory.
Come to the colloquium. Yes, yes. So this is very much part of the subject of quantum topology that all started with the Jones polynomial. Okay, and then sort of further on the subject of von Jones, a 2-1 subfactor. So what on earth is that? Well, that's, shall I write this? This is a pair of von Neumann algebras. What else do we need to say? They have trivial center and whatever. There's a trace on these algebras, a trace of the identity is 1. Don't worry about that, that's just the definition of these gadgets. A 2-1 subfactor gives a fusion category as the you can make this tensor category of n bimodules generated by M. So here we've got a pair of algebras sitting one inside the other. So in particular, the big algebra here is a bimodule over the small algebra. You can multiply on both sides by elements of the smaller algebra. But you can look at all of the n bimodules, which you can build by using this particular guy, M, as an n bimodule. And it turns out that gives a fusion category, well, a not necessarily finite one. In the definition of a fusion category, remember we asked if there were finitely many simple objects. That doesn't come for free in this setting. So there's some connection with operator algebras and the whole theory of subfactors. And in fact, this fusion category you get is an extremely strong invariant of the subfactor. And with a few more adjectives tacked on, it's actually a complete invariant. So studying subfactors in some senses becomes equivalent to studying fusion categories. And this is originally the way that I got interested in the subject, even though some of these other things are now perhaps more exciting. Okay. So, what do I actually want to tell you about fusion categories today? Well, I want to go back to this picture here. And show you that there are some interesting places to look in this picture. So I want to exhibit some points. Maybe let me draw the two that I'm going to talk about. I'll call H and EH for now. And H maybe is not so far from the boundary of the representations of finite groups. EH is kind of out there in the wilderness, or at least appears to be for now.
So I want to exhibit 2 points and discuss how exotic they are. So maybe the thing that I'll say is that these examples were both discovered through efforts to classify all fusion categories in certain regimes. It's not like imagine you were discovering the classical Lie group G2. It's not like we discovered G2 by realizing that it was the symmetries of some natural object we cared about anyway. This is like discovering G2 by working out what all the possible Dinkin diagrams are and realizing there's one sitting on the list we've never seen before and going back and sort of rebuilding the object from some sort of combinatorial invariant that showed up. And these guys here that I'm going to talk about really were discovered in that manner. That is, they were discovered in a manner completely lacking insight or understanding about where they came from. We just sort of went searching and they were sitting in the places where we searched. To some extent, now one of these points is better understood and one of them is still very poorly understood. So maybe at this point, let me just advertise a paper on the archive, which is a recent survey article we wrote about this whole problem of sort of searching for examples of these types of objects. It's perhaps at least slightly readable, I'm not sure. Okay, so to actually exhibit these points is going to take a few moments of somewhat terrifying looking definitions. I'm actually going to write these things down explicitly in all their gory detail. I'm not entirely sure how this will go. Any questions about what I've said so far before I write a few formulas on the board?
Can you characterize the column groups, the representation of column groups in the fusion category? Abstractly, like
that's a good question. So maybe one thing that you might look at is I could draw a sort of another loop that circles both of those, but that cuts out these exotic points that I'm about to describe. And these are the graded tensor categories. So remember I talked about a tensor category being symmetric, you can just swap x and y. There's a slightly weaker notion where you can swap x and y. But when you swap x and y and then swap them back again, you end up with that. You don't end up with the identity. You get some map that sort of remembers that you braided them in some interesting way. So certainly all these classical guys sit inside braided tensor categories. But we certainly know there's lots of stuff in that gap. There's still braided things that don't fall in either of these groups. The conjecture, the possibly very unlikely conjecture, I feel like it's wrong, but everyone else in the field thinks that it's very plausible. Is that if you, well, let me, I guess I need to say one more thing. There's the notion of a center. You can take any old fusion category you like, say X, and compute it's a Grinfeld center, which is some new fusion category, but that's always great. So there's some way of sort of smooshing everything down into this smaller thing. And the conjecture is that this isn't precise. Braided tensor categories mod centers of fusion categories for some sense of mod is exactly the class of representations of quantum groups.
I personally have no idea why anyone ever believed that conjecture. Certainly no one has practiced it. But the actual question you asked me for a characterization, I don't think I know.
So let's do a little bit of work and try and explicitly exhibit two fusion categories. So we'll consider a tensor category C. I'm actually going to try and show you at first a whole family, not just two, and then we'll discuss what actually happens. So we're going to have an integer parameter here, L, greater than or equal to zero, and just to avoid writing too much, N is just going to be 2L plus 2. Okay, so this category C we're going to think about is tensor generated, I'll talk about what that exactly means, by a self-dual object. So this is an object which is equal to its dual. We'll call this object X. And just two maps. T stands for trivalent vertex. Draw some pictures in a moment. Which is a map from X tensor itself back to X. And another one, S, which is a map from the trivial object to the 2n tensor power of our object X. Okay. Now, what does all this mean here? That is, every object in our category is actually just a summand of the eighth tensor power of X for some A. So you find the trivial object by taking the zeroth tensor power, X itself is the first tensor power, and then as you look at the higher and higher tensor powers and watch how those break up into symbols, we're just going to see everything in the category amongst those. And that's somehow going to justify concentrating very much on this object X. So moreover, every morphism, every map in this category between two tensor powers of X, say between the tensor power A and B, is built. Is that me? I'm sorry. Is built out of these guys we talked about, T and S, using planar operations. And let me draw a picture that illustrates this. So what I mean is that this vector space here is just given as the linear span pictures like this, and I might draw in a rectangle with, we're going to have A points along the bottom. That's for the source object. And then we'll have B points along the top. And then inside, you just see some graph built out of T and S. Draw this. Okay. So the trivalent vertexes here are labeled by T, and the big blobs are labeled by S. And I'm going to have to put a little marked point on the boundaries of the S's to help keep track of orientations, which I'll explain in a moment. Because the subjects of fusion categories and subfactors already have way too many operations indexed by stars, we had to use a new symbol as this base point. Early papers used stars here as well, but it meant that there were four different stars within one paper. Dollar signs were a big technological improvement in understanding papers about subfactors. Okay. So let's say a little bit about what this picture means. to interpret this picture. Scan from top to bottom, from bottom to top. Okay, and as you scan from bottom to top, you'll see various things. As we start from the bottom here and go up, the very first thing we're going to see here is this little minimum in this string, a little critical point. So when we see that, we read this as this duality. This co-pairing map that goes from the tensor identity to X tensor X. Remember, it used to be that I had to put a dual in one of these two factors, but we're talking about a soft dual object now, so this pair, this co-pairing map goes from the tensor identity to X tensor X. Similarly, whenever you see a maximum, you interpret that as the duality pairing map, X tensor X back to the tensor identity. So just to make sure that we're all on the same page here, we start at the bottom and we're looking at X tensor X because there are two dots here. And as we read up to here, once we pass the critical point, we're looking at four copies, X tensor X tensor X tensor X. And we've used this map here, which you should think of as the identity on X tensor, let's call it co-pairing map C for a moment, tensor C tensor the identity on X. Okay? That's a map that goes from X tensor X to X tensor X tensor X tensor X. Okay. What else do we need to do? As we pass a trivalent vertex, we interpret that as our favorite map there, T, from X tensor X down to a single copy of X. And when we pass a copy of S, at least when it looks like that, sorry, I know some of you probably can't see the bottom of this board yet. I've just drawn here an S with all its hair sticking straight up. We interpret that as the map S from the tensor identity to this 2nth tensor power of X. Now, of course, as you scan from bottom to top, you might not actually see things sort of arranged like this. You might pass an S with some of its hair hanging down instead of all of it up. So I want you to sort of comb the picture first so that everything looks like one of these pieces and before you start scanning. So what I've given you in this little recipe for scanning is, given any picture like this, I can actually build a particular morphism in the category just out of these guys by composing them and taking tensor products. So just using the basic operations of a tensor category, you can interpret a picture like this as a particular morphism. And what I'm saying here is actually the category that we want to describe is a category that's generated by these maps, and that means that every morphism in this space here is of this form or is a linear combination of morphisms of that form. Okay, so we're now, I guess, halfway to the definition of what C actually is. I've defined for you a spanning set for all of these morphism spaces, but I need to tell you some relations as well. These diagrams satisfy some relations. Okay, so very quickly, let me just write down a few numbers. If I write m in square brackets, I mean this this quantum number. Oops, I just some particular rational function of q. And what's q? Well, q is determined by quantum 3. That's q squared plus 1 plus q to the minus 2. I'm going to tell you some specific number is the largest eigenvalue of the adjacency matrix of this particular graph. Okay, a little bit strange. The backstory here is that when we were going looking for possible fusion categories, we realized that there might be some associated to graphs that look like this, And then we went back and worked out that if there really was such a fusion category associated in some way with this graph, it would have to satisfy all the relations we have about to write down. But in this presentation, this graph is just appearing out of the blue. And I just want to quickly say for L equals zero, quantum three here is some very concrete number. Just so we're here. Here's zeta is this 13th root of unity. And for L equals 1, quantum 3 is also something you can write in terms of a 13th root of unity. Okay, one more number. Let's have lambda depending on L. Let me just tell you it's square. Who cares? These are just some particular, this is some particular real number that depends on the parameter L. Okay. So, what are the actual relations now that these diagrams satisfy? I just need all those numbers written down so that we can write down the relations. Okay. If you see a closed circle, you can just delete it from the picture and multiply by this number, quantum 2, which is just some real number. Okay. If you're just looking at trivalent vertices, you can replace that linear combination, an I minus an H, with this linear combination, diagrams that don't even have any trivalent vertices. Let me just mark that relation as Q for later. So the point here, these relations you can apply anywhere inside some bigger picture. So here, if I happen to see an I, maybe I was looking at this picture instead, I could just cut out that little neighborhood of the I and replace it with the other three terms in that relation. Then there's some relations involving S's. If you see an S with a cap attached to it anywhere, that's zero. If you see an S with a trivalent vertex attached to it twice, that's zero. And where the marked point lies on an S doesn't really matter. It's just there to keep track of signs. That is, if you rotate an S by one click, you just pick up a sum. Okay. Two more relations. Let me just make sure they actually fit on the board. If you see two S's connected by exactly half their strands, so that's n strands there, you can replace this with some explicit real multiple, well, of a right-hand side, which I'll postpone talking about for just a second, and the most hideous relation of them all, oh dear, okay, almost there, don't worry. Okay, now the one final thing I need to say is here, these boxes with FJs in them. This is the something called the Jones-Wenzel idempotent, and it's just some linear combination, some specified linear combination that people who actually work in this field know and love of diagrams with only trivalent vertices. Okay, so let me just interpret these pictures for you for a second. This is saying if you see two S's connected together by enough strands, you can radically simplify the diagram, get rid of a pair of S's and get something here which might have lots of terms, but has no S's in it at all. On the other hand, you just ignore the box underneath this and just pretend the left-hand side didn't have the box there, and you'll still get the right idea. If you see an S with a string arcing over the top of it, you can replace that with some hideous linear combination of diagrams which are hideously more complicated. They have more S's in them, but all of those S's are closer to the top of the page. Sort of, you should think of this picture as letting you move an S through a strand at the expense of becoming more complicated. Okay. That there is the complete definition of these categories. It's very complicated, but I did actually want to put it all on the board so you would see exactly how complicated the objects we're talking about are. Okay, so what on earth can we say about these categories in the remaining few minutes that we've got? Okay, so obviously this is a crazy definition. The things that we can say about it, for L equals 0 and L equals 1, these really give fusion categories. Now the history was that L equals 1 was understood earlier by Hagerup. In the L equals 1 case, it took quite a while. And there's actually, if anyone actually wanted to learn about some of the details here, this paper is reasonably accessible by the standards of this subject. So what does a theorem like this say? Well, it says a whole lot of things. First of all, it says that if you just take all these relations, they're consistent. That is, there's no way of taking these relations and proving that 0 equals 1, okay? Which you might imagine is possible. It also proves that these categories are semi-simple categories, which seems like a very difficult thing to do just based on having a bunch of diagrams and relations. You actually show that these categories are unitary. They have a star structure and a beautiful positivity structure that gives you semi-simplicity for free. You also show that there are finitely many simple objects. The one thing that I want to show you that happens in here is that is in particular the tensor identity is a simple object. That is, this tensor identity doesn't decompose into smaller pieces. And what that means is that anytime you have some closed diagram, that is a map from the tensor identity at the bottom to the tensor identity at the top, so the closed diagram gives you an endomorphism of the tensor identity, that's going to be just some scalar, okay, some multiple of the identity map on the tensor identity. So we're claiming that these relations are sufficient to evaluate all closed diagrams. You draw an arbitrary planar network of S's and trivalent vertices, and you can use this to simplify. And this is the key relation. It basically says you can take any of the S's you see embedded in your complicated diagram and drag them out towards the boundary of the diagram. We call this the jellyfish relation. We think of them as little jellyfish floating along to the surface. And they reproduce as they go, maybe you get more and more S's as you go, and they're trailing these immensely complicated tentacles behind you, but the jellyfish all end up on the surface. Now, once all the jellyfish are up on the surface, an easy combinatorial argument tells you that they're actually two adjacent to each other, connected by enough strands, and so the surface, the boundary now starts simplifying and shrinking in diameter until eventually there's nothing left. So that's the sort of planar topology that goes into proving theorems like this. Okay. The next theorem is that for L greater than or equal to 2, they will collapse. In fact, these relations let you prove 0 equals 1, although the proof is entirely non-constructive and makes a huge detour by a number theory, which is kind of cool. And then the third thing to say about these is that...
What do you mean they collapse?
Okay, it means that I can start with the empty diagram. Okay, no picture at all drawn on the board. Now I can apply some relations. For example, I might decide I can write this as 1 over quantum 2 times the circle, using that relation. Now I might do that a bunch more times, until somewhere in the picture I see a copy of sort of one term of this Jones-Wendel item, or the whole Jones-Wendel item. Then I might replace that with this pair of S's. Then I might drag one of my S's through a pair of strings somewhere, do it again and again and again. And then I might, after I've got something big and complicated, I might simplify it all back down again to the empty diagram and get it. Many, many, many steps later, 2 times the empty diagram. And so this tells us that the field we're working over is the zero field, that all our vector spaces actually collapsed in the zero vector space. There's no reason why these relations have to be consistent. That is, we're thinking of these relations as giving us a way of taking a closed planar graph built out of S's and T's and evaluating them to numbers. But it might not be a consistent way of evaluating to numbers. And if it's not consistent, then the tensor category we've defined is just the zero category, where all the morphism spaces are zero.
Okay. So the final theorem to say is that, well, maybe let me not even write it for now. There are only essentially 3 fusion categories. Okay. The L equals 0 and L equals 1 points of this construction realize some of the few examples of fusion categories we've found by doing exhaustive searches. Okay, so let me just quickly pull up that picture again. Rep G. Those searches that we did somehow, in some sense, are kind of looking for a little neighborhood of a point that's sort of classical. So maybe here's a very short version of this theorem. These are 2 out of 3 of the only fusion categories with an object take that statement with a grain of salt. Since I'm running out of time to say this, this is kind of a schematic version of what the real theorem says. But somehow you should think that we were looking for fusion categories with an object that has dimension very close to 2, between 2 and 2 plus epsilon, say, for some epsilon. Of course, if you're just doing finite groups, that's boring because there's no integers within epsilon of 2, but somehow we're searching close to 2 in the setup. And so, and these are the points that we, two of the three points that we found there. So how on earth might you show that these guys are not classical objects? So, I mean, they don't have integer dimensions, they're not in here. How might you be sure that they don't come from quantum groups or any constructions starting in this classical world and building up? The proof that they really are exotic introduces some very nice number theory. So I'll just say it rather than writing anything, because I have run out of time. But the representation theory of any finite group, you can write down over a cyclotomic field. That is, you can take all your vector spaces to be defined over Q adjoined some root of unity. The root of unity depends on the exponent of the group you're looking at. But you can write down all of the structure of these tensor categories defined over a finite field, defined over a cyclotomic field. Similarly, for quantum groups, sort of automatically you can do this by construction, really. You can write down the representation theory of a quantum group at a root of unity over a field involving only roots of unity. But what you can show is that even though, if you carefully follow through all these numbers, for L equals 1, L equals 0 and L equals 1, all these numbers I wrote down were actually in the cyclotomic field, just involving a 13th root of unity. So you might think, oh, okay, so these categories are defined over Q adjoined a 13th root of unity. But you'd be wrong. When you actually go and look in detail, just being able to write down all these defining relations over the cyclotomic field doesn't mean that the category is semi-simple over that field. And what we could show is that if you look at some field in between Q adjoined a 13th root of unity and the complex numbers,
can ask, is this definition the definition of a semi-simple category over that field? You find that there's an explicit answer, yes, if and only if this field contains some particular number, this lambda L, the square root of this quantity, and that number is not cyclotomic. Okay? So there's a really intrinsic sort of number theoretic construction that tells you that these points you've found here are very different from the old points. Anything that starts with sort of the classical examples just can't produce things like this, because you'd always be working over a cyclotomic field. Okay. I'm out of time. Okay. So the one thing I want to say about this picture is that last sentence, I promise, is that we understand very, very little at this point. We don't have any of the structure theory. We have finite groups, normal subgroups, simple groups, all that stuff. We've done a little bit of searching. We've found a few things. Is there lots more out there? Is there nothing out there? It's hard to tell. Perhaps the right analogy is that it's like the night sky. It looks all blank at the moment when you stare at it from down here in the city, but you build a big enough telescope that lets you zoom in on one very small patch of it, and suddenly it's full of stars and there are lots of examples. But we've got no classification of them, no sense really of what the final picture is going to look like. Thank you, and sorry for going over time.
Thank you very much.